This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
At South by Southwest, the digital divide becomes personal. Homeless hotspots coming up. Also, apparently a $25 billion mortgage settlement takes a while to work out. Also, Don Cheadle and the House of Lies on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcast.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 12th of March. And this is a big week down in Austin, Texas. South by Southwest is in full swing. There's music and movies and technology at South by Southwest Interactive. And that's where we start today, because we saw a thing this morning that literally made us ask whether it was real news or something out of The Onion. Homeless hotspots. Homeless people wearing T-shirts labeling them as homeless hotspots. Turns out they're selling wireless internet access, but the whole thing is getting a lot of negative feedback. Exploitative was one of the kinder descriptions we've seen. Sunil Radia works for BBH. That's the marketing and communications firm behind the experiment. We got him at a homeless shelter down in Austin. Sunil, thanks for being here.
Good to be here.
So let's dig a little bit. You're in Austin for South by Southwest. You can't get online. You need a Wi-Fi connection, and you see a homeless person wearing a shirt that says homeless hotspot. What do you do? How does it work?
The short version is, what we're doing is we're trying to reinvent the street newspaper model. And when we looked into it, we realized that actually they do a lot more than just provide money for the homeless. They give them a social interaction that's actually quite critical to their success. And so we thought that reinventing it would give us an opportunity to kind of bring the homeless out of kind of invisibility as we've seen them treated at big conferences and such.
Let's remind people what street newspapers are. They are newspapers sold by homeless people, sometimes content generated by homeless people, and then they get to keep the proceeds.
That is exactly right. And so the goal is to go and make you introduce yourself. So there's no way to hop on their 4G network without going and speaking to them. That's that social interaction point. These aren't just people that are antennas. It's somehow been implied in this like kind of hardware implication that looks bad. They have a service that they offer, which is to get you online. And they generally tell you their story. And then once they tell you their story, you know, you get the code, you text in, and then you can join their network. And then the money goes directly to them for the access you just got.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but did you think about how it looks? Because it just looks not great.
Absolutely. I think that's a very fair question. You know, what's interesting about it, though, is everyone who's dug below the surface has left with a very different perspective. And I wish that anyone who knows someone in Austin or is in Austin currently goes and speaks to one of these people. There is no way to engage with one of these people without feeling quite warm-hearted about it. So, you know, I hear the point about if you got a 140-character update from Twitter that it looks bad. That said, look at any of the original source information and you realize this is actually a program with exceptional amount of integrity trying to help people.
I'm going to try this again, perhaps less delicately. It sounds almost condescending. It sounds, look at these homeless people. We're trying to do this nice thing for them. Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, and I apologize to anyone that's offended by that. Many of the street newspapers that we've been speaking to realize it's actually not condescending. What we're doing is we're taking a model that exists already, street newspapers. It's really that social interaction point, the ability for them to express themselves, to be a bit entrepreneurial. Again, if you really get into the experience, it is the opposite of condescending. It's very empowering, actually.
When you guys were brainstorming this, did you anticipate the blowback? Did you think about this?
You know, certainly we did think about it. I mean, it would be naive not to think that, you know, this is going to be debated. And by putting this model out there and letting people debate, this is what worked in their program and this is what didn't work, we're actually uniquely qualified to say, okay, we can take our licks for whatever we got wrong. What we're motivated by is what the people who adopt it get right as a result.
Sunil Radia. He's the director of innovation at a company called BBH. It's a communications firm in New York City. We got him down in Austin, Texas at South by Southwest. Sunil, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Kai.
So what do you think? Condescending or a good idea? Let us know online. Marketplace.org is the website. On Wall Street today, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Remember a month or so ago, there was all that hoopla about a big settlement between banks and regulators over mortgage fraud? We had Sean Donovan, the Secretary of Housing, on the broadcast talking about it. $25 billion to take care of charges of robo-signing and improper foreclosures. We mentioned at the time we hadn't seen the actual agreement yet, what the paperwork actually said. Well, now we've seen it. A month later, it was filed in federal court in Washington this afternoon. We asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Ganser to go find out what took so long and what the whole delay has meant for homeowners waiting for help.
The deal is expected to help about a million borrowers with payments, refinancing, and reductions in what they owe. The settlement involves banks, federal agencies, state attorneys general, and banking regulators. Scott Talbot is chief lobbyist for the Financial Services Roundtable. He says with that cast of characters and the size of the deal, delays were inevitable.
There's a substantive piece here, there's an economic piece, and there's a political piece as well. So all those boxes had to be checked to help us get to the point where we are today to help the homeowners.
Among the homeowners who could be helped, 34-year-old Ben Kruger. He and his wife are underwater on their Minneapolis home, but current on their mortgage payments. Kruger says homeowners in the most dire situation should get priority, but he's glad the settlement sets money aside to help people like him.
They still have their houses underwater. They're still having the progress they thought they would have in life impeded by this dip in the housing market. Everybody's lost the equity in their house.
For Kruger, that's meant postponing plans to buy a bigger house after the birth of his 7-month-old son. He's also hoping the settlement will help prevent more foreclosures in his neighborhood, which drive down the value of his home. Across the country, in the Los Angeles area, Francesca Leah Block is guardedly hopeful. The home she bought in 2007 is now worth $150,000 less than she paid for it. The deal between the government and the banks requires banks to assign a single person to work with some homeowners. Block has been trying to negotiate with Bank of America for a year.
And how I got off the phone crying hysterically, you know, a few times.
Block says she was passed around from person to person and would just like one bank representative to deal with, to sit down with, and lay it all out to see if she can find a way to stay in her home.
See, you know, this is what I have. This is what I can afford. What do you need from me? Please let me know.
Block's case is complicated. She bought her home under her mother's name, then her mother died. Bank of America says it can't help until the house is in her name. Block says she'll keep working on that and hope to eventually have that face-to-face meeting. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
A reminder today from the world of marketing. A big part of selling something, as we all know, is just the way you talk about it. It's not a tax increase if you call it a revenue enhancer, right? It's not a down day on Wall Street. It's a buying opportunity. Well, along those lines, for-profit colleges are trying to change their image by changing their language. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Amy Scott reports.
The campaign was dubbed Project Rose, as in Shakespeare's A Rose by Any Other Name. The Chronicle of Higher Education got its hands on the plan. The for-profit college industry's main trade group was pushing members to lose the business jargon and speak like educators. Instead of parent company, try university system. Recruiter? How about counselor? And my favorite, a piece of business, should be called an applicant.
It really wasn't until too long ago that people really thought for-profit in general was antithetical to education.
Kevin Kinzer teaches higher education policy at the University at Albany. He says for-profit colleges have been working to shed the image of an industry focused on high enrollment above all else. Schools like the University of Phoenix and Kaplan have been accused of leaving students with lots of debt and degrees of questionable value. Communications consultant Michael Maslansky says other industries have played with words to repair their reputations. Remember used cars?
Now you go buy a pre-owned vehicle, and it's had a full kind of review and makeover. It's been tested. So the language changed, but so did the industry.
The for-profit college industry is changing, too. Not exactly by choice. Recruiters, pardon me, counselors, can no longer be paid commissions for signing up students. And some schools offer free trials to weed out students who are less likely to succeed. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
I thankfully managed to dodge having to go see The Lorax this weekend, so Universal Studios won't be able to count any of my money toward its number one box office position for that film. Coming in at a very distant second place was John Carter, the Disney film about a military officer mysteriously transported to Mars. Normally, we wouldn't do a story about the number two movie, but John Carter is one of the most expensive films ever made, expensive as in more than $200 million. It's also on track to be one of the biggest flops ever. So what does an entertainment company do with a flop like that? Marketplace's Jennifer Collins found out.
Disney was trying to make a star.
You're John Carter of Earth?
Yes.
John Carter wasn't just meant to be one film. That huge budget was a kind of down payment on a franchise of John Carter's.
What Hollywood's trying to do here is recreate an adult audience for adventure movies.
Edward J. Epstein is the author of The Hollywood Economist 2.0.
But this seems to be, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark set in Mars or something. So it's a science fiction. It's mixing genres.
And adults in the U.S. didn't get it. So those sequels are likely out. The movie did bring in $100 million worldwide in its opening weekend. Not bad, says Paul DeGarabedian, who tracks box office data for Hollywood.com.
All that matters is balanced against a $250 million budget. That seems like not a strong opening.
Add even more costs for marketing, and analysts estimate Disney will take a loss of more than $100 million. Tony Weibel of Janney Capital Markets says the John Carter flop is likely to cause the company to take fewer risks on unfamiliar franchises.
You know, we'll ultimately probably be at a point where you have, you know, two Pixar movies a year, maybe two Marvel movies a year, and Disney only putting out films that they feel have real brand value.
Weibel says Disney is hoping the international box office, DVD sales, and TV rights will help limit the damage from John Carter. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
There are some questions being raised in London this week about a hostage rescue gone wrong. British and Nigerian commandos tried and failed to rescue a Brit and an Italian being held in northern Nigeria on Thursday. The two men were killed by their captors as the raid went down. France has seven nationals being held in Africa, perhaps, critics say, because the French government tends to pay ransom too easily. John Lawrenson reports now from Paris.
French hostages returning last year to a hero's welcome, alive and well after almost 2 years held captive in Afghanistan. How much did France pay the Taliban to get Hervé Guéquière and Stéphane Taponnier back? The rumour was $25 million and the release of 17 Taliban prisoners. French Foreign Ministry spokesman Romain Nadal says,
"Our position is clear and constant. We don't pay any ransom for our hostages."
But the emergence of Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, or AQIM, one of whose ransom demand videotapes you're hearing, is stretching the credibility of the official French position to the limit. AQIM is an Algerian-led outfit operating across a vast swathe of the Sahara Desert. Alain Chouet, former head of French counter-terrorism, says AQIM is mainly in it for the money.
Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb is made up of 300 to 400 people, many of whom have criminal backgrounds. Taking hostages for ransom has been its stock in trade since the outset. We know the Germans and the Swiss have paid. The French deny it, but I don't see how they could have obtained the release of hostages without some sort of financial settlement.
Algeria says Western countries have paid AQIM a total of $70 million in ransom, transforming it from a bunch of bandits with shotguns to a well-armed and sophisticated terror operation. Worse still, paying ransom has created a sort of hostage market. Renaud Girard is a veteran war reporter with Le Figaro newspaper.
As a reporter, I don't like to have on my forehead when I walk in the streets of Kabul or in Kandahar written like $5 million.
Girard says paying ransom has made life for him and his compatriots more dangerous.
Recently we had a very good example, gangsters from Somalia, decided to go down to Kenya just to kidnap a French old lady who was living there because they knew that the French government is weak and would pay.
But does it have a choice? Jean-François Julliard is Secretary General of the Paris-based Reporters Without Borders, an NGO that campaigns for press freedom.
Government should do their best to secure the release of hostages, even if they have to give some money. They can just let hostages be killed by the kidnappers. They can't. They can't.
But other countries disagree.
Edwin Dyer has been murdered by an al-Qaeda cell in Mali. The Prime Minister goes on.
Britain's refusal to negotiate with Dyer's kidnappers in 2009 perhaps explains why Akim hasn't taken any British hostages since. But this doesn't alter the hard truth that had the British government negotiated, Dyer might have been alive today. Radio France reporter Christian Chenot was held hostage in Iraq for the last 4 months of 2004, along with another French journalist. He was, he says, very glad to be French.
When you know that your country will try to make the maximum of efforts, it's better than to be a British or an American that you have doubt about the will of your country to get you back.
But Renaud Girard says if he were taken hostage, he'd like his government to do something else.
I would like to see special forces intervening to try to kill the hostage takers. If I'm killed in the operation, tough luck. If I'm not killed, I will write a very exciting article.
In Paris, I'm John Lawrenson for Marketplace.
Coming up, actor Don Cheadle on his new show and what it takes to thrive as a management consultant.
Stay important, stay vital, stay needed, right. at any cost.
But first, let's do the numbers. Fed meets tomorrow. Investors sat on their hands today. The Dow Industrials added 37 points, just over 0.25%, ended at 12,959. S&P 500 was flat, 1371 at the bell. The NASDAQ down 4 points, a 0.1%. Closed at 29.83. Lousy day for most bank stocks. Shares of J.P. Morgan Chase and Morgan Stanley each coughed up about 1%. Bank of America slumped 0.75%. Investors applauded a leadership makeover at PepsiCo. Shares bubbled up 1.25%. Today, the dismal opening of John Carter we told you about didn't faze Disney shareholders at all. The shares scurried up 0.25%. Now, I don't know where that at all came from. Bond prices didn't budge. The yield on the 10-year T-note held steady at 2.03%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve meets to discuss interest rates and the economy. The Commerce Department reports on retail sales for February. And starting tomorrow, NFL free agents can shop their services to other teams. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Elections are, in a perfect world, about what the people want. The world is rarely perfect, though, which is why you don't often hear politicians asking people what they want. As part of our election coverage this week, we've done some asking around about what's really on people's minds, what they want out of this election. Today, Liz Herman. She's a community banker outside Philadelphia.
Here's what's important to me this election. We need to figure out the right balance between what we spend on social services and what we need to do to bring down the budget deficit. On one hand, social services are important. I'm a community banker, and I've seen the gap between the haves and the have-nots increase with each passing year. As a member of several nonprofit organizations, I find it tragic that the very individuals who need social services the most are the first casualties of local, state, and federal budget cuts. It hurts not just individuals, but society as well. The loss of those services affects the quality of life for all of us. But we've got to do something to rein in that federal budget deficit. My fear is that all of us baby boomers who haven't saved sufficiently for our retirement will continue to ask Peter's grandson to pay for Peter's needs today. I worry we're eroding our country's ability to ensure a better life for our children. A gaping budget hole is not the type of legacy I want to leave my family. We need to decide now on a plan to start paying down this debt. but let's make it a plan that involves appropriate contributions from everyone. A simpler tax code for both corporations and individuals would be a great start. Another way to reduce the deficit is to grow the economy. I'm concerned that government regulation and unnecessary oversight are hurting economic growth, not helping it. Cutting the deficit alone will not make us a stronger nation, nor will unchecked spending on social services. But it can't be an either-or proposition. I believe that the path to good government is discussion and compromise, not inflexible adherence to ideologies. And I bet there are many Americans who believe the same thing. We all need to get out and vote and make our voices heard.
Liz Herman manages a community bank branch in East Greenville, Pennsylvania. Take a second. Tell us what's important to you in this election. You go to marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. You got your masters of the universe in big business, your bankers and your brokers and corporate chieftains. You got your analysts and traders as well. But then somewhere a bit lower on the pecking order, I'd imagine, are the management consultants. They swoop in, tell you you're doing everything wrong, charge you a gazillion dollars plus expenses, and swoop out management consultants. That's how Don Cheadle plays his character Marty Kahn in the new Showtime series House of Lies. Let's just say Marty's not a sympathetic guy. He practices what you might more accurately say is kill or be killed kind of capitalism. Today in our series, The Art of Money, what artists and others see when they look at the economy are Don Cheadle and House of Lies creator Matthew Carnahan. Thanks for coming in, you guys.
Thanks for having us.
Pleasure to be here.
Let's play a little piece of tape just to set up sort of the premise, I suppose, of what this thing's all about. Go ahead and hit that.
After work. After work really is the goal of all consulting. Get them thinking that their business is going to fail without you. They hire you week in and week out. That's millions and millions in billable hours.
Don Cheadle, your character, basically with the philosophy of life right there.
Yeah. Stay important, stay vital, stay needed right. at any cost.
Literally at any cost. I mean,
yeah, however
and whatever the costs are, by the way, bill it to the client.
That's right. Marty Kahn, I think he's a rascal.
Were he not so misanthropic and greedy and sometimes evil,
right.
Rascal would be good.
Yeah. He's a Disney character, but with some Showtime juju on him.
Well, Matthew Carnahan, let me ask you then, what were you, as you took this book and tried to turn it into a television program, how did you see it evolving?
I imagine you've met a number of management consultants.
Oh, yeah.
It's not the sexiest world on the face of it. I started to interview young management consultants. My brother's a senior partner at a large
consultancy. Oh, is that right? Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fabulous.
Yeah.
So, I have to ask you now, what does he think of this whole thing?
Honestly?
Or do you
have not heard from him? Sweet from me. Yeah.
You've agreed not to talk about it?
I have not heard from him.
Yeah. Thanksgiving should be very interesting.
That's going to be a great holiday. Thanks for asking.
Give me the elevator pitch that you went to Showtime with and said, listen, I have this idea. Here it is.
Oh, God.
that's kind of how he started.
That was sort of it.
You're going to hate this, but
yeah.
Prepare to be underwhelmed.
That's right.
Are you ready for something sexy? Management consulting.
Yeah, I know. That's exactly it, right?
Well, luckily, David Nevins loves the business world and who's the head of Showtime. And we went in with a way to kind of do a pants down, upskirt look at the business world, you know.
The thing about it, though, is that when my wife was in business school, she did a summer's worth of consulting. And she was traveling and this and that. And she hated it. It was horrible.
Yeah.
You know, it's just not a nice, fun way to make a living.
No. Yeah. This pod that he works with.
The gang of four, you know.
They sort of become the de facto family, this dysfunctional family. Yeah. But that's who they have. You know, they have each other for, 5 days out of the week and on planes and then going into these places where they feel like it's them against us and we have to get out of this place with what we got to get out of. And their missions, you know, they're like, we've been dropped in behind enemy lines. We got to get out of this place.
This is a little grand, but it's a little bit like, not combat, but there's certainly an edge to what goes on.
Well, I think they feel like it's combat. Yeah. I mean, I think those are the analogies that they use in ways that they're trying to create subterfuge and then go in and, set up the flank them this way. I'm going to run left. You're going to run right. And then we're going to get the flag. And
what we try to do is slightly away from combat, but a caper. You know, it's basically a caper show.
Right. I should point out that you're an executive producer of this broadcast.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean for you in terms of how you approach this project that, that deals with business and the economy and
bigger,
you know,
paycheck.
Your role in it? Bigger paycheck, yeah. Also, well, though, right? I mean, he's on the hook if it goes nowhere.
Yeah, more money, yeah. No problems.
Yeah.
No, I mean, what's great is that the whole team, we're really all in the mix all the time. So, you know, we've already ramping up to go into our next season, which we got the pickup for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've already started tossing these things around. What are these big ideas that we're going to be talking about this year? What are these storylines that we want to jump into? And it's just a part of the process that continues, I think, to make the show really rich and interesting for me.
Other than your brother, who's the management consultant, mm-hmm. have you heard from real-life people in this industry?
Many, yeah. And I do hear from a lot, especially of young management consultants. It's like, how did you know about the thing that we do with the points where we trade Starwood points for how much sex we have?
Oh, my God.
So, you know.
I don't even want to know.
Yeah, no, you don't. It's very sordid.
Could this series have happened without the financial crisis? Do you think people would care enough?
I don't know that I would care enough. We were all just ticked off. The 1%, 99%, there's a lot going on mm-hmm. that points toward this show for me personally being something I want to explore. And the financial crisis made it feel urgent. And it just seemed fun to go at it from the side, from a guy who's just about as unscrupulous as they are.
Matthew Carnahan and Don Cheadle from House of Lies on Showtime. Guys, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today in which the words March Madness pass my lips for the first and last time this basketball season. The NCAA basketball tournament starts this week, as you might have heard, which means we're soon to be swamped with stories about how much productivity we lose because of people skipping work to watch games or watching online at the office or what have you. Always some terrifyingly large number, it always seems. And yes, in fact, here it is. The manpower company Challenger Grain Christmas says we're going to lose almost 4 million hours of otherwise productive time this year. 3.75 million is the number. How much does that matter in the grand scheme of things? Not a whit, says John Challenger. Not even a blip. And thus, let March Madness be said no more. Apologies, by the way, to my basketball fan friends out there. You know who you are. All right, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 37 points, about 0.25%. The NASDAQ up 0.25%, less than a fraction. The S&P 500 down 4 points, about 0.1%. Our producers include Gina Delvac, Justin Ho, Millie Jefferson, and Fiona Ng. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us back here tomorrow. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.